Hello, this is Sarah with the News Gazette, dated August 7th, 2026. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined Delay of Game for College Sports Legislation by Jeff DeLisio. Champaign. After months of debate and discussion, consternation and compromise, the congressional backers of legislation to clean up college sports have a bipartisan bill that's been blessed by the NCAA, the Big Ten, the SEC, and yes, President Donald Trump. Now comes the hard part. It becomes about moving past the substance of the bill and really moving into the advocacy stage and trying to put ourselves in position to lift it through Congress and get it across the finish line, Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman said this week on News Gazette Radio. Which, as we know in today's day and age, is not always the easiest thing to do. College sports fans, new to following the inner workings of Congress, learned Thursday just how high that final hurdle can be. On what bill sponsors Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell hoped would be the eve of the Protect College Sports Act being called for a vote in the Senate and easily passing the 60-vote threshold needed to advance to the House, the Congressional Black Caucus raised an 11th-hour objection. In a 742-word statement, U.S. Representative Yvette Clark, Democrat, New York, said the caucus and its 62 Democrat members of Congress could not support advancing the Protect College Sports Act in its current form, objecting to the lack of opportunity for Black athletes, coaches, and agents. The caucus itself, an historically Black college input bill. While not addressing any of the specific provisions of the legislation, Clark said in part that it falls short of providing Black athletes with the rights, representation, economic opportunities, and meaningful safeguards they deserve. A second whammy came not long after, when the Congressional Labor Caucus four co-chairs issued a statement against the bill's passage, saying it does not go far enough to adequately protect college athletes, their rights to their name, image, and likeness, NIL, and their fundamental right to collective bargaining. Earlier this week, Cruz and Cantwell reiterated the urgency to act fast, given that Friday was scheduled to be the final day of the session, and that many senators would soon turn their attention to re-election efforts ahead of November's midterms. The optimism around the bill last Friday night, when the Big Ten and SEC announced their public support of the rejiggered Protect College Sports Act, turned to pessimism 6 days later and led Trump to demand action. Flanked by members of Team USA Thursday at a White House event, the president said he was urging the House and the Senate to come together, bipartisan if possible, and it looks like that's what they have done, and send the bill to my desk. I will sign it immediately. I think we have no choice, he added. We have to get that done. We have to get that done. And if we don't, we're very foolish. Nobody knows what's going to happen. We're in Never Never Land, and we're not going to let that be happening. Whitman, who chairs the NCAA Division I cabinet, remains high on the bill in its current form. When asked whether it solves all of the biggest challenges facing college athletics, he said on News Gazette Radio, "Well, all's a big word, but I think it certainly takes really meaningful steps towards many of the biggest challenges facing college athletics. Among those steps, it would allow schools to share up to $48.8 million in revenue with student athletes, up from the current $21.3 million allowed as part of the landmark House versus NCAA settlement. In addition to the $21.3 million, schools would have a $22.5 million retention fund to help keep their own student athletes from entering the transfer portal, plus another $5 million exclusively for Olympic sports. I hope among athletic administrators is that the expanded salary cap would render many of the oft-messy third-party NIL deals unnecessary. It would just create a more efficient system, a system that's more, I saw a term recently, intellectually honest about how we are compensating student-athletes and for what we are compensating them, Whitman said. While no school is obligated to share the full $48.8 million, Whitman said, certainly Illinois would hope to be at the top end of that. No more unlimited transferring. Like the pre-portal days, student-athletes would be permitted to switch schools once, and only once, before having to sit out a season. The NCAA and conferences would be granted a limited antitrust exemption to implement many of the key provisions, including the revenue share cap, the transfer rule, a 5-year eligibility model, and registry for agents. It may not eliminate all court challenges to the NCAA rules, Whitman said, but it does include a set of antitrust protections that would be very helpful in providing some stability and predictability around the college athletics ecosystem. For example, it takes the transfer regulation and puts it into federal law, Whitman said. You would also see a lot of state law that has been passed over the past few years trying to put each state's institutions in a more competitive position become less relevant, and in some cases not at all relevant, which would be very helpful. It's not foolproof. There are still some areas where we could be subject to legal challenge, but it would go a long way. Certainly, antitrust has become the popular vehicle for the most meaningful litigation against the NCAA and the conferences, and this would help us a lot on that front. Savoy Village Board. Silos have a chance at being even more iconic. Painting of mural on them for documentary PBS series proposed. By Jana Wiersema. Savoy. A row of grain silos isn't exactly a traditional landmark. But for Savoy residents and those who visit the community often, the old agricultural equipment at the northeast corner of East Church Street and US 45 or Dunlap Avenue is a very familiar sight, one that village officials say has been around for a long time. According to a recent post on the village's Facebook page, the Savoy Grain Company built the grain elevator in 1929 and added the first silos in 1939. Nearly a century later, the village is considering working with a muralist to create artwork on the silos that could be featured in a nationally broadcast PBS series, though there are several questions village trustees would like answered before funding the project to the tune-up of $85,000. I love the idea of the project, said trustee Larry Canfer. I, for years, wanted to have a mural for all the reasons that you stated, to create a sense of place in Savoy. What better starting point than this iconic building to say that you've arrived in Savoy? However, he also felt that the timeline is a little too rushed. Savoy economic developer Sam Harnick presented the proposal to the village board during a study session Wednesday night. The grain silos are one of the most recognizable landmarks in Savoy, and as you know, they're one of the first things people see as they enter the village, Harnick said. And they're directly adjacent to our future downtown. While redevelopment of the site itself is unlikely due to the cost, we have an opportunity to transform it into something that reflects who we are as a community. This project would convert an otherwise unused structure into a destination and a point of pride for residents. She explained that filmmaker Oscar Guerra is creating a docuseries for PBS called Walls, Art for All, with the upcoming season focusing on artwork completed by Rafael Blanco. Blanco is a San Antonio-based artist who has also completed murals at the Urbana School District's Adult Education Building and on apartment buildings at 804 West Illinois Street in Urbana. The village has been approached about the possibility of supporting a mural project by Blanco on the silos, with the work being filmed for an episode of the series. The hope is to begin work on the mural on October 12th and be done on November 1st, weather permitting, Harnick wrote in a report to the board. Filming would occur during this time. Staff will work with the filmmakers to line up residents and businesses for the artists to visit and interact with during filming, she said. The series is slated to air in the spring of 2027. Considering the looks of the silos and the way they've looked for years and years, I saw this as a potential opportunity to make a big impact on our community and make something that people would be proud of, said Village President John Brown. Harnack also noted that thousands of people would see the mural as they drive through a major thoroughfare that connects Willard Airport to the University of Illinois campus. Local businessman Kyle Kirchhofer owns the property at 100 to 108 East Church Street where the silos are located. Kirchhofer is the owner of Savoy's restaurant, Kyle's Corner, and was formerly involved with the village's effort to create a downtown square on property just west of the silo site across US 45 Dunlap Avenue. The village was presented with the mural and documentary proposal toward the end of May, which is too late to get it on the agenda for the trustees' June meeting, Harnack told the News Gazette. Given the cancellation of the July meeting, Wednesday ended up being the first opportunity to present the idea to the board. Harnack said that she, Blanco, and Kirchhofer would all be involved in settling on a design that has a meaningful connection to the village. The project is estimated to cost $85,000, with $35,000 being an eligible use for tax increment financing, TIF dollars. It's proposed that the other $50,000 would come from the village's Economic Development Initiatives Fund. Harnack added that staff would also pursue other funding sources, including grants, sponsorships, and private donations, to decrease the village's contribution of its own funds. An application has already been submitted for a $12,000 grant from the Illinois Arts Council, and Harnack feels confident that the funding will be approved. She told the board that, of the total cost, $35,000 would go to the mural, while the other $50,000 would go towards the creation of the documentary. "This is how the film gets made, is through funding," Harnack said. Stamford, Connecticut, they helped fund the pilot episode, for example. Each community or organization within a community is helping fund those things. Village trustees generally indicated interest in the mural project, but also had a number of questions and concerns regarding aspects such as design creation, paying for the documentary to be made, and what might happen if the privately owned property were ever sold. One of the biggest concerns was how quickly the board would have to make a decision in order to be featured in the series. In discussing the timeline, Harnack said the filmmakers would have liked to have an answer in July. As it is, they need to know the village's decision as soon as possible. "If we don't get on their schedule, they're going to try to fill this time slot with somebody else, and that's perfectly fine," she said. She noted that the village could pursue the mural project at some point in the future without being part of that documentary series, which has to finish filming by end of fall. Capital News, Illinois. State Committee begins to look into representative amends, by Ben Zielinski. Springfield. Illinois lawmakers on Thursday began investigating alleged misconduct by Representative Carol Amends, Democrat of Urbana, that was outlined in a federal indictment. Amends pled not guilty on July 16th to 10 felony charges, including wire fraud, lying to the FBI, and conspiring to obstruct justice. Her husband, Champaign County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Amends, also faces a conspiracy charge. Their daughter, Tatiana Amends, was not charged in the case despite being a key figure at the center of it, though she is facing separate federal unemployment fraud charges. The House Special Investigation Committee was triggered by a Republican petition that largely mirrored the indictment, alleging Amends engaged in inappropriate and illegal behavior. While the committee will decide whether the 11-year state representative engaged in conduct unbecoming of a legislator It's just the first step in a long process that could ultimately lead to her punishment. And after introducing the House Republicans' charges against Ammons, the committee voted unanimously to consult with the U.S. Attorney for the Central District of Illinois to find out if it would interfere with the federal investigation. The committee will not meet again or conduct a deeper investigation until the U.S. Attorney responds. History. Area history in 1926. A third sudden death. That of Jacob Michaels, Champaign's former chief of police, has been added to the already complicated murder mystery of the deaths of Morgan Knox 2 weeks ago and Anna Carmody, his suspected killer, last week. Michaels, an intimate social and business acquaintance of Carmody's, testified yesterday at a coroner's inquest into her death that he knew nothing of it. But then six eyewitnesses claimed they saw him shoot her. As Sheriff John Gray prepared to arrest him, Michaels slipped a gun from his pocket and shot himself in the head. The scene is described as the most dramatic ever witnessed in Champaign County's criminal history. In 1976, only last week, church members raised the brick garage behind the parsonage to make way for the new addition to St. Joseph Church of Christ. The addition is to extend west from a 1951 addition, with the north wall along the alley and the south wall cutting through the garage site. In 2011, after presenting Tom Brown and Peter Black with their trophies for winning the senior and junior divisions, respectively, of the Twin City Golf Championship, tournament committee member Scott Peters introduced the overall champion. And for the 15th time, the winner of the Twin City, Peters, started. He was joking, of course, but it sure seems like Clayton Parkhill has won the thing more than a dozen times. The former Champaign Central and Illinois golfer put the finishing touches on his tournament record-tying fifth championship with a 1-under-par 71 Sunday at Lincolnshire Fields Country Club. International history, today's highlight. On August 7, 1974, French high-wire artist Philippe Petit performed an unapproved tightrope walk between the two towers of the World Trade Center in New York, over 1,300 feet above the ground. The event was chronicled in the Academy Award-winning documentary Man on Wire. On this date, in 1789, the U.S. Department of War was established by Congress. In 1960, Côte d'Ivoire gained independence from France. Top of the morning. Something to get you going today. Courtesy staff writer Luke Taylor. Bellying up with, on Fridays, we'll spotlight the men and women serving up cold ones and conversation in our neck of the woods. Let us know about your favorite bartender by emailing ltaylor@news-gazette.com. Not everyone can say their mom encouraged them to go to a bar, but Noah Henson says it's the only reason he's been working at Collective Pour, and that was what pushed him to try it. He'd been considering a job at a fast food restaurant and was about to take it when his mom convinced him to go to an interview she arranged for him. It was a blessing in disguise because I really did end up loving working at the bar, and I've been here since then, Henson said. He spent a year as a barback before moving into an actual bartending role, where he's enjoyed getting to invent at least one cocktail, called the Victory Parade, in honor of his favorite team, the Bears. The real best part of bartending, in Henson's opinion, though, is getting to take the time to relax and talk with customers in a way he wouldn't have been able to in the fast food industry. It's a pretty laid-back environment. We talk with people, get them what they want, and it's just a great time, he said. He's a big fan of sharing the location with Smith Burger Company, and not just because it's convenient on lunch breaks. The restaurant brings a family-friendly atmosphere to the location, drawing people in who may then want something from the bar, while the bar crowd doesn't have to go far if they realize they're hungry after a couple drinks. Henson's a big fan of all his coworkers, too. You'll see behind the bar, we're just having a great time. We'll give a good vibe for you, where you can talk with us and joke with us and be part of everything. Ailing Kentucky Senator McConnell discharged to continue recovery at home, Washington. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky says he's been discharged from a rehabilitation center and will continue his recovery from home. The former Senate leader was first admitted to the hospital on June 14th. He disclosed weeks later that his hospitalization was the result of a fall and said he was undergoing physical therapy. McConnell, 84, gave no specific date for his return to the Capitol, but senators are expected to soon leave Washington for the traditional August recess. Votes are unlikely for the next 5 weeks once they adjourn. On the advice of my doctors, I'll maintain an intensive regimen of physical therapy from home during the state work period, and I'll continue to engage with my staff and colleagues on important Senate business, McConnell said in a statement released by his office. McConnell had polio in his early childhood and has long acknowledged some difficulty walking and climbing stairs as an adult. The Office of the Attending Physician has said McConnell was undergoing a strenuous course of physical therapy and rehabilitation since he left the hospital, which includes multiple sessions a day designed to rebuild strength and reduce the risk of future falls. The senator is determined to finish out his seventh term, which concludes in January. McConnell's absence is being felt in the Senate as Republicans were unable to advance a farm bill out of committee Thursday. The committee's chairman, Senator John Boozman of Arkansas, said he spoke with McConnell this week about the bill. I know how much he would have wanted to be here to advocate for Kentucky's farmers and rural communities, Boozman said in kicking off the committee's meeting Thursday. But there's also been criticism that McConnell has not been transparent enough about his health. The state's Democratic governor, Andy Beshear, recently called on the senator to either prove that he is fit to continue serving after his lengthy hospital stay or resign from office. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. Party line vote calls for holding Fauci in contempt. Legal validity of move seen as questionable. Washington. The Senate committee voted along party lines Thursday to hold Dr. Anthony Fauci in contempt of Congress over his refusal to answer questions at a hearing on his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, setting up a referral to the Department of Justice for potential investigation over whether the country's longtime top infectious disease official properly exercised his constitutional rights. The vote approving the contempt resolution came a week after Fauci invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination more than 100 times when he appeared before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, an episode that raised fresh legal questions about the ability of Congress to compel testimony from a previously pardoned witness. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, the committee chairman, who pressed for the contempt finding, said that constitutional protection did not apply because Fauci last year received a pardon from Democratic President Joe Biden and thus did not have to worry about the threat of prosecution. He said he intends to send the referral directly to the Justice Department rather than first to the full Senate, despite Democratic questions over the legal validity of such a maneuver. Dr. Fauci faced no risk of federal prosecution, Paul said at the outset of Thursday's hearing. All he had to do was tell the truth. Fauci, in a statement last week explaining his decision to invoke his Fifth Amendment rights, said he had good reason to fear the possibility of criminal charges given what he had said was Paul's determination to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, quote, behind bars, unquote. Fauci's lawyer, David Shurtler, said in a statement that the contempt resolution was a continuation of Senator Paul's personal vendetta against Dr. Fauci, who spent 50 years in public health and has saved countless lives. Schertler accused Paul of abusing his power by trying to weaponize the Justice Department. Today's partisan committee vote is a crude political stunt intended to punish Dr. Fauci for exercising his constitutional rights, Schertler said. The Senate should reject Senator Paul's meritless and politically motivated contempt resolution. For years, Senator Paul has proclaimed to anyone who would listen that Dr. Fauci should be prosecuted and put in prison. Dr. Fauci has committed no crime, and Senator Paul knows it. Image shows Dr. Anthony Fauci testifies before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee hearing July 29th in Washington, D.C. Epstein files. New Mexico sues to demand handover of evidence. Cedar Crest, New Mexico. New Mexico's Attorney General sued the U.S. Department of Justice on Wednesday, accusing it of blocking the state from investigating sex crimes at Jeffrey Epstein's former ranch near Santa Fe. The lawsuit in federal court in Washington, D.C., said the department and acting Attorney General Todd Blanche stonewalled New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres's criminal investigation into Epstein and others, taking action that harms victims and undermines the public interest. The lawsuit sought judicial intervention to force the federal government to turn over materials to New Mexico's investigators. It was filed the same day that the New Mexico House of Representatives released a report saying, "Those directly responsible for protecting New Mexicans relied on others to do their job, including federal prosecutors in New York." Epstein took his own life in a federal jail in New York City in August 2019 after he was denied bail on sex trafficking charges lodged against him when he was arrested a month earlier. Epstein's former girlfriend and close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, is serving a 20-year prison sentence after her 2021 conviction on sex trafficking charges in New York. Witness testimony at Maxwell's trial alleged she and Epstein had sexually abused women at his New Mexico ranch. According to New Mexico's lawsuit, state prosecutors have faced sustained resistance to the kind of information sharing common between state and federal investigators. The Justice Department said in a statement it was not releasing some of the information the state requested because of federal court orders that banned disclosing victim identifying information. New Mexico has provided no lawful basis to justify such sweeping disclosures, the agency said. Daybook Almanac. There are 146 days left in the year. Notable birthdays. Singer Lana Cantrell is 83. Actor John Glover is 82. Actor David Rash is 82. Former diplomat, talk show host, and activist Alan Keyes is 76. Country singer Rodney Crowell is 76. Actor Caroline Aaron is 74. Comedian Alexi Sale is 74. Actor Wayne Knight is 71. Rock singer Bruce Dickinson is 68. Actor David Duchovny is 66. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the August 7th News Gazette. Please stay tuned.